This podcast is brought to you by the Marvel vs. Capcom Fighting Collection Arcade Classics. 7 legendary titles including X-Men vs. Street Fighter and Marvel vs. Capcom 2. Enjoy new features like online multiplayer, training, and gallery modes. Plus, join in on the action with one-button specials, where players of all skill levels can unleash those epic moves with ease. Relive the classic arcade battles. Get your hands on the Marvel vs. Capcom Fighting Collection today. Available now on PlayStation 4, PC, and Nintendo Switch.
Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/redcircle.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to Comic Book Club. I'm Alex, and we are here on day 3 of Terrificon in Connecticut in beautiful Mohegan Sun Casino. I'm not paid to say that, but I'm going to say it anyway. And we're here with one of my favorite guys to talk to. I feel like now we only check up at Comic Cons, but yeah. Tim Seeley, welcome back to the podcast.
Good to see you. You're like tabling. You've got books out. You're in the hallway?
Uh-huh. It's weird. It's actually very nice. I was worried, but everybody has to walk
by
this table.
You.
It's great.
Because the Artiselli is good, but it's a trek. Like, when this thing opens, it takes 45 minutes for people to get back there anyway. So, yeah, you're on the way.
Yes.
You should have nothing on the front of that table.
I'm really screwing up. I'm screwing up, Tim. You're not screwing up, though, because you're very busy. You've got a lot of big projects coming. I do want to talk about one, and I probably should have vetted this before we got on.
Sure,
I'll put it up after it's out.
Okay.
But I read Local Man this morning, the one that's coming out this Wednesday.
Okay.
Are you cool talking about
absolutely.
It a little bit?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll hold for spoilers and everything. Big issue, end of a big arc. Really upsetting as well.
Hopefully, yes.
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 Yeah. So, I mean, talk to us about this a little bit. For anybody who doesn't want spoilers, turn away. But
okay.
By the end of the issue, multiple characters that we care about have died. Status quos have changed.
Yeah.
As usual, you're playing with a lot of very deep continuity Image Comics history. So talk a little bit about what the goal was with this arc, I guess.
I mean, it's a good question. I don't know. I think the way that we approached this book was sort of that, you know, it would be about the fact that Jack is sort of the opposite of this sort of Image superhero, and that the Image superhero characters, when these guys came in and started doing these books, they were doing superhero books, but they all kind of thought, to some degree, like, the standard rules of a superhero were lame, right? Like, they, no sidekicks, you know, they thought that was dumb. Like, they were sort of, it's Gen X reacting against this sort of golden age, silver age stuff. So one of our thinkings was about this book was, you're going to think he's this standard sort of Image character, that he doesn't care about anybody, just needs to look cool. Like, we've set this sort of up from the beginning, that it was all about Image for him and everything. And then you kind of hopefully see over this the three arcs that make up this sort of initial story is that, you know, Jack's actually the opposite of that. He acts like he doesn't give a shit, but he keeps doing superhero shit.
Yeah.
Right? He could leave and he could be not part of this and he could not care because they don't care about him. Everybody's mad at him, but he keeps doing superhero shit. Almost sort of is like he's compelled to do it, you know? So hopefully it kind of gives you that sense of like what, you know, what we were playing with his characters, that we love that initial Image stuff, but I'm also we kind of hold some of that stuff responsible for, you know, the sense that superheroes are lame and, you know, we want these badass dudes all the time. It's like, okay, what if someone was just good? Like, what if that was a story about someone who just did good things? And I think Jack, as you see him in the story, is he's a fuck up, right? He makes mistakes and he has human foibles, but his, you know, as you go along, you see, like, oh, he actually cares about this town, despite himself and despite them.
Yeah.
Exactly, you know.
Well, this arc in particular, he's facing down something called the Faceless Horde, which they sort of got the Cobra Commander masks out a little bit. This, to me, feels like the most explicitly political arc you've done.
Yeah, for sure.
Because you have this group that is invading small-town America, telling them there's a better way. Talk about that
a
little bit.
And I think if you look at the other ones, you can see the explicit politicalness of it, too, because in part, you know, the motivation for everybody hating Jack is this, you know, he when he left, there was a promise that there was going to be, you know, him getting elevated was going to help the town, too. They were going to bring in this training center, and that was going to mean jobs, and it was going to do all this sort of stuff. And then it didn't happen, and they held it against him, and he's kind of like, wait, why? Because he forgot that that was sort of the promise that he had made, which is the Foxconn thing with Trump, right? Like, that was him outside of Milwaukee, and that's a thing I think you consistently see is these sort of populist politicians come in and promise small-town America these things, and then they don't give it to them, and then they wonder why these people are bitter.
Yeah.
Or why they're disengaged from politics, or why they, you know, the sort of sense that they are forgotten, which, you know, I come from those places, and I know why. I had to leave those places because there is no opportunity there. You know, there's sort of a dead end in an American small town, which is you can live okay if you get that factory job, and you can, you know, maybe become a manager, but there's an end for you, right? That, and there's no possibility of being a creative, really. There's no, you know, you have to leave to do those things. So that was always kind of part of the politics of the story. And I think in this one, you see a group come in and promise them this better life and that they deserve it and that they should take it, but it's all in service to her, right?
Yeah.
So you can see the obvious political allegory there, I'm sure.
Yeah. By the way, it just occurred to me while you were talking, it's funny to call this the most political arc you've done when I think two issues back you killed Dan Quayle.
Right, yeah. So, right. Yeah, exactly. So maybe not the most. I mean, and, you know, the putting Dan Quayle in there was also just a sort of almost a test and a little bit of a statement is that, you know, 30 years ago, Dan Quayle was this huge thing in politics, 25 years ago. And we put him in the story, and he's the main villain, and we kill him, and nobody said shit. So it also tells you about the political life of these mm-hmm. people, because, you know, at a certain point, they represent to people this savior or this, like, you know, here's this good Christian Indiana politician. He's going to do for us. And he didn't do shit, and, you know, and he becomes nothing. And that is that's what's going to happen to Trump, and that's what's going to happen to all these people eventually, right, is that they lose value after their moment is gone. So, you know, it was kind of a joke to put Dan Quayle in there, but it was also sort of like, you know, this is the standard for how politics works in America, and that you're some kind of big star, you've got all this power, and then you're just, you know, some guy that we made the joke in that issue where the slick, you know, Rudy, she's like, who? And he's like, you don't know who Dan Quayle is? She's like, I have no idea. You know, she calls him Don Quayles later, like she has no idea. And that's how it is, you know, it's just yeah. that these big moments are usually followed by return to status quo, and we just forget you're nobody, you know?
Yeah. To get back to this issue, the moment that made me geek out the hardest is Inga gives a couple of the local people superpowers.
Yeah.
She gets powers. When she showed up, I was like, oh, that's kind of like a Spawn outfit.
Yeah.
And then two pages later, you reveal it is a Spawn thing, and she's got the countdown clock.
She's got the power counter, yeah.
That was great. I also appreciated the fact that you sped through the power counter in one issue rather than having it go 50, 60 right. issues.
Right. Which is actually just kind of a, you know, I remember when I was a kid, when I first started reading Spawn, the power counter thing was like my favorite part of that. It had stakes, you know? And obviously after a while, Todd was like, oh shit, I can't kill this guy off. This is like, this thing is, you know, running an entire company. Like Spawn is the most important IP in all of Image Comics. So it went away eventually. But the potential of it was always so great, you know? Like the stakes for that character were so high. So we borrowed it, sorry Todd, with great love, you know, and partly just to show the sort of redemptive arc of Inga having actual stakes.
Yeah. Well, and again, this is a big spoiler, but at the end of the issue, she dies because of this power counter, because of other things. What led to the decision to take her off the board?
I mean, a big part of it was always going to be that it had to have big stakes, and I think the Logan Man is super contained and condensed. Like, these arcs are only four issues long.
Yeah.
But on purpose, because, you know, I think there's a tendency to draw out big moments and sort of stuff. And one of the amazing superpowers of Tony Fleece is that he'll go through my notes and my story stuff, and he'll cut shit, and it still has the same emotional impact, which is amazing to me. Like, I don't know how he figured out that particular comic skill, but you can see him use it in Feral, and you can see him use it in Stray Dogs and everything else he does. So, you know, going into this last arc, I think this is too much stuff. And Tony's like, we can do it. And you know, he cut out some stuff and moved some stuff around, and that's how we got that issue, which I think it still plays. Like, it was always the intent, but I think my worry was that it wouldn't be as set up as it needed to be, because we only did this 4 issues. But I think it plays, and I think the way 25 follows it really works, because, mm-hmm. you know, then we've got this guy who's gone through his superhero arc, and he's kind of got what the premise of the book was. He's got that conclusion, but now what? And that's what the next issue is about. Is now what, right? Like, yeah. what is the next step for this character?
Yeah. And one quick last thing before we move on to something else. I thought it was very interesting, the backup story. These started as very broad parodies, or at least on the surface, very broad parodies. But it slowly feels like the real world is leaking through to the point that you're explicitly dealing with racism and old Image comics in here.
Right, yes.
I mean, is that a conscious effort?
Oh, yeah.
Or is that...
Yes. Okay. I mean, you know, we go through this, and I don't... You notice it, but I don't know if other people, and maybe it doesn't matter, but for us, we use it as a parameter to inform how we do the stories. And so, you know, Image guys going in and saying, we're not going to do sidekicks because sidekicks are lame, and then us introducing a sidekick. Mm-hmm. All those things are reactions against this sort of, you know, the real history of the what Image was and what it did for comics, what it did for superheroes, what it did that was bad for superheroes. So all that stuff was kind of part of the story. But yeah, in this case, it was, you know, shit, what was I talking about? What was the question? I've just rolled
the
over.
The backup story?
Oh, yeah, backup. Yes, thank you. In the original Image stuff, you know, Chapel and especially Youngblood, Chapel and Sentinel were both revealed to be bad guys. Spoiler.
Oh, no.
They were the two black guys in the stuff. And I remember there being kind of a backlash, but, you know, lower because it was like the late 90s. And as a kid, I remember being like, well, that's kind of fucked up. You know, like the two black guys on this team are both revealed to be bad guys.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and I know that wasn't by Rob a choice to do that, like to be that, but it is indicative of sort of like a blindness to that kind of shit back in the 90s, right? It was just, mm-hmm. you know, we're not thinking about how these characters matter to people in the real world. So a big part with this character, you know, Aerator, who... His complaint, he's like, I'm always in the background. You know, I'm always in the upper left-hand corner jetting off in the image, which is a joke that we put in there that goes all the way back to the first issue, you mm-hmm. know, when he first shows up on the cover. And that we wanted to play that off as sort of be this really blunt kind of punchline to you know, how those characters were sort of treated and what they meant. And, yeah, they got to be on the superhero team, but, like, they weren't ever, you know, sort of anything more than possible. We could turn this guy into a bad guy, or we could kill him off for drama, you know? So poor Aerator had to get that out of his system, you know? Yeah.
Well, I love that. Last thing I'll say on Local Man, and I hope this is okay with you. First of all, thanks for putting me, Justin, Pete, in an issue.
Yeah.
Somebody brought over a copy of issue 8 and had me sign it.
Oh,
is that
awesome.
Okay for you?
Yes,
okay.
Fantastic.
All right, cool.
Excellent. We love it.
That
we
was a great
it.
Moment. Now, going back to the beginning, we first started talking to you with Hackslash, and you mm-hmm. are coming back. You and Stefano are coming back for Hackslash Body Bags.
Yeah.
Why was this crossover the right thing to come back for the anniversary?
Well, sort of, it's so Stefano and I have been working on this book together for 20 years. 2024 is the 20th anniversary. And we have a really weird and unique relationship, in part because, you know, when I made up this book, and I was looking for an artist, and I asked Stefano, because I'd worked with him as an editor when I was doing Micronauts at Devil's Due, and he was like, yep, I'll do it, bro. And he did the book, he drew the shit out of it, then he fucked off and worked at Marvel for 20 years. But he has always been part of the book. We co-own it together. I offered him a percentage when he drew the book. Great investment on his part, but also great investment on my part. So we've always owned it together. And so for our 20th anniversary of the book, this was my anniversary present to Stefano. His favorite comic of all time is Body Bags.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, what can I do for Stefano for sticking around this long, you know, and working with me on this book for so long? And so I reached out. I knew Cully Hamner, and I asked him, you know, if there was a possibility of working on Body Bags stuff. And Cully put me in touch with Kevin Gardner, and then Kevin put me in touch with Jason Pearson's mother. And so we pitched them this idea, and they went for it, which is fucking crazy. But in part for us, it was, you know, Body Bags has been off the shelves for a while. You know, Jason has passed away. He's amazing, and he was an amazing artist, but his creations were, I think the best thing he did was Body Bags. So if we could, you know, do a Hackslash thing and have a great time for our anniversary and reintroduce the world to Body Bags, then we went, right? I thought there's no way that we would this would not work. So, got to give Stefano the chance to draw this. Got to write this story that was weirdly pairs perfectly together. And you could see the influence of body bags on Hackslash. Obviously, when I designed them, Vlad was more sort of a Jason type. But when Stefano got in there, he became more of a Mac, clown face from body bags type.
Yeah.
Down to the, big cleavers and shit. When I drawn him, he was more hunched over, and I gave it to Stefano. He's like, great. And then it came back. He's like, I see your body bags leaking through. But we're paying homage to something that was obviously really important to us. But it's also just a great way to reintroduce the stuff and to do a chapter in Hackslash that totally makes sense as far as a story connection. And I think the inherent sort of value of Hackslash is so flexible. Like, it can do just about any damn thing, which we've proven by doing fucked up crossovers for 20 years or putting in a strange situation. And this one is just like, it flows seamlessly.
Yeah. Not you, but Zoe Thurgood also finished up Hackslash Back to School, which was awesome. Do you think you'll do more experiments like that where you sort of like pass it along
Absolutely.
To other folks?
Yeah, I mean, it's more fun for me to do that than just about anything else. Yeah. I mean, Zoe is closer in age and gender to Cassie than I ever was. And, her voice, her take on it was completely different than something I would have done. And that's great. I mean, I also kind of feel like, she came into it. She was a fan of the comic, so partly her partner Joe was a fan of the comic and sort of like said, "Hey, I'll help you do it." They came into it and had a good time. Zoe enjoyed doing that book. I think you can see it. If I can find people who come into this with I love this book. I would love to do something with it, but they read it when they were like fucking 6 or 7 years old. Great, and I feel like I also have to pay it back because. One of the first books I ever did was Love Bunny and Savage Dragon, and Eric let me use his characters, for no money. I feel like I have to pay that back, it.
That's awesome. I think this was just announced. You're doing a project which seems very atypical of you, Archie Comics, Mr. Justice, which, as far as I read, and you take it away from here, seems to be like a very earnest superhero take on Archie.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, what could you tell us about it?
So Archie came. They pitched it to a bunch of writers. So it was Blake Howard and Manna Diebert and assortment of writers. They said, "We'd like to work with you guys, and we want to do Archie has done superhero stuff before. Pure Heart, the Powerful, and then the Red Circle characters, and all that associated stuff. But I think they kind of felt like." What if we did this and treated it not as a joke? We took the sensibilities of Archie and put it on a superhero thing. And then as we all started working on it, it's like, wait, this is perfect because this is that sort of, and maybe it seems kind of out of my realm of things, but if you look at Local Man, how much I actually like the sincerity of superheroes, then this is in my realm. Taking what makes Archie this sort of old-fashioned American ideals and this, sincerity, I guess, which is so rare now. What if we did that as a big superhero tale? So I was like, yes, I'm in. When I was a kid, when I started reading comics, we started getting into it. My parents had both grown up reading comics. And so my dad was like, hey, I used to read Spider-Man and Fantastic Four and all this stuff. He had thrown out his comics, so he didn't have them. But he went and bought me a bunch. But my mom had read Archie, Pep, Veronica, all that stuff. And she still had hers. So she gave me those comics. So for me, when I was growing up, those comics represented the same sort of excitement as superhero stuff. I just knew they were comics. Yeah. I didn't care. So if I could do more Archie stuff, I did the Archie horror stuff, which is great. But this is like the actual sincere Archie. We're talking about the romantic triangle, his relationship with Jughead. But it's through the filter of this kind of superhero template. So Jughead becomes this kind of Jimmy Olsen kind of character, and Veronica becomes she's sort of the daughter of Lex Luthor, essentially, because Hiram Lodge is sort of that character. So we get to, it's sort of like whatever happened to the Man of Tomorrow via Archie.
I guess. I love that.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
and treated sincerely.
Yeah. Well, another one that you're doing, which is a fun mashup, is Turtles of Grayskull.
Oh, yeah.
I love slash hate Turtles with hair.
That's me too.
So weird, but so great.
Yes.
Where did that come from? Where did that idea?
The genesis of the whole thing is that Mattel was re-releasing these Master of the Universe Origins figures and stuff, and so they have these great molds for doing the old figures, and the great thing about Turtles is the license is relatively open on the toy front, and you'll notice this if you go to Target or something. You'll be like, hey, there's the NECA toy Turtles, and mm-hmm. there's the Playmates Turtles, and there's the... Because everybody does them because they're always successful. You know, there's a whole line of Transformer Turtle crossovers and stuff. So Mattel was like, let's combine these things, and so they came up with those awesome designs. And they turned around and asked me to come up with like a mini-series story for it. There's an existing mini-comics that come with a toy story. So they gave me designs and said, just write whatever the hell you want. So Freddie and I came up with this thing, and ours kind of runs parallel to the toy story in a way.
Okay.
But Freddie loves Mikey with hair, and I hate it. And so we made a whole thing in the story that I think ties it all up together, and it leaves it up to you how much you love Mikey with hair. But it's obviously funny having the page boy haircut of He-Man, you know.
No, it's very, very funny. It's just it has that uncanny valley nature of you're like, something's wrong.
So, yeah, it makes me just a little ishy, and I don't know why. Yeah.
And last and most certainly not least, Revival is finally being made into a TV show.
Yeah.
Right? What's the status of that right now?
I mean, they're far enough ahead now that the Pride Parade was in St. John, Canada yesterday, and the staff and crew of the TV show went marched with Revival signs and shit. So,
oh, wow.
So they're like, going.
So they've made signs.
They have made signs.
We're at that stage.
Yes,
hopefully a TV show someday.
Will come out.
But they made
signs,
so that's good.
But, yeah, they're, like, staffed up with writers. They've got scripts in. They've started casting. I know who's in it, but I can't say until it's all signed up. And it starts filming September 1st.
Oh, that's
so
awesome.
It's like a real thing, which is this is the farthest I've ever gotten on this shit.
Yeah.
I got Hackslash up to like, casting and location scouting, but no pride parades and no shooting, you know? So this is, my God, I think they're going to do it. But
and that's going to be on Sci-Fi,
Sci-Fi
right?
Network, yeah.
Okay.
And the people made it. It's the producer and the director and then some of the... associated other associate producers who did the film Revealer that I co-wrote with Mike Maurice. So that ended up kind of being like a dry run for how to do a production like this. Luke Boyce, who's the main director on this, is a guy I met at C2E2. Mm-hmm. He just came up to me, and we had just, Mike and I had just sort of run out a deal with NBC to make a Revival TV show, and it just didn't go well. And Luke was like, hey, I'm a guy from downstate Illinois, and I want to make this TV show. And we're like, all right. And it took him 7 years, but he worked every day on this thing and met all these people. He had done a lot of directing for, like, commercials and stuff. He developed this, brought the team together, and then the sort of dry run version was Revealer, and they figured out how to do all this stuff. And now they put together this thing. They pitched Sci-Fi. As far as I understand, we're like the last TV show greenlit in Hollywood before everything has been really crazy lately.
Yeah.
So we got really lucky, and they worked really hard, and it's happening as far as I know.
So, oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
That is so great. Now, that's a lot of stuff that we talked about.
Yes.
But before I let you go, is there anything else you'd like to plug?
Oh, let's see. Do I have anything I'm supposed to plug? Shit, no, I can't announce the other two things I'm working on. But they'll be coming soon. But always a pleasure to sit and talk with you and actually be in your presence, Alex. It's usually on the phone or Zoom or some shit.
Yeah,
so,
for sure.
And at a table, at a con, like in our natural environment.
Yes, our natural habitat.
Yeah, right.
As it were.
This is where we should be.
Thank you so much. Always
pleasure.
A pleasure. Congrats on everything. Can't wait to see Revival and everything
else. Man. Thank you.
And if you'd like to support our podcast, patreon.com/comicbookclub. Also, we do a live show every Tuesday night at 7 p.m. to Facebook and YouTube. Come hang out. We would love to chat with you about comics. Apple, Spotify, Android, or the app of your choice to subscribe, listen, and follow the show at Comic Book Live on Twitter/X, comicbookclublive.com for this podcast and many more. Until next time, we'll see you at Terrificon.
Sit on crappy couches and they let the seats
This podcast is brought to you by the Marvel vs. Capcom Fighting Collection Arcade Classics. Seven legendary titles including X-Men vs. Street Fighter and Marvel vs. Capcom 2. Enjoy new features like online multiplayer, training, and gallery modes. Plus, join in on the action with one-button specials, where players of all skill levels can unleash those epic moves with ease. Relive the classic arcade battles. Get your hands on the Marvel vs. Capcom Fighting Collection today. Available now on PlayStation 4, PC, and Nintendo Switch.